Good morning and welcome to MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue, and we're coming to you from the campus of Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and the studios of WMOT-FM. With only a few days to go before the inauguration of Barack Obama as the 44th President of the United States, we thought we'd take a little bit different tack and look at the incoming administration from an historical perspective and see if we can place into context the times into which Obama will be stepping and the problems with which he will be dealing with how some of his 20th century predecessors dealt with similar problems in their era. You may recall the cover of Time magazine that showed Barack Obama's face over FDR's body and the discussion of whether a new deal is needed. Well, that'll just be one of the topics that we'll be touching on today with Dr. Chris McCusker, who is a professor of history here at MTSU. Thanks for being with us, Chris.
Thank you for inviting me.
What was your reaction when you first saw that Time cover with FDR in the town car, head back, smiling, but it was Barack Obama's face juxtaposed over him?
Well, the original photo is very interesting because the person next to him was a very dour-faced Herbert Hoover. And the idea with the original photo or the picture was to sort of give this, oh, everything was bad, sort of dour persona in the face of Herbert Hoover. And happy days are here again in this sort of gleeful look that FDR had. But I think there's a lot of we want to have that actual comparison. We want the one-for-one comparison with the Great Depression, with the era that we're living through now, because it's scary. But the depth of the economic recession that we have now and the actual depth that FDR was dealing with in the 1930s are two very, very different. So that Obama, in some ways, is a new FDR in that he's got that eloquent way of speaking. He's able to use new media in really profound ways. In Obama's case, it's electronic media, particularly email. In FDR's case, it's the use of radio and his ability to speak directly to his constituents. But in terms of the crises that each is dealing with, there are very, very different things. So I cast a bit of a jaundiced eye at that cover in reaction to it. The recession that we're going through right now is certainly a very scary moment. Our college accounts for our kids have dropped to minimal. Our retirement funds have evaporated. People are losing jobs, 533,000 last month alone in our area. We keep hearing about, particularly in Laverne, hundreds of jobs just disappearing overnight at Whirlpool, Bridgestone, Firestone, and it is indeed very scary. But our unemployment rate is in the 6.5 to 6.7 scale. In the state of Tennessee, it was 7.0. During the Great Depression, the national unemployment rate was 25%. In heavy industrial centers like Chicago, Cincinnati, Detroit, it was 50%. In some industrial centers in Ohio, it was 80%.
And the chattering class, every time you turn around, is comparing the current economic climate to the Great Depression, which it tends to, I think, fuel the fear or at least the possibility in people's minds that the next Great Depression is just around the corner. But what you're saying is that the comparison is not really valid if you look at the facts.
No, it's really not. Beyond the differences in unemployment rates, 9,000 banks went under during the Great Depression. I think we're up to number 19 or 20 this year. And granted, we're talking about a bigger space of time. There were no government programs at the time. There was no unemployment compensation. There were no food stamps.
No FDIC.
Nothing. And certainly, it wasn't all solved with the Great Depression, but the Great Society and different programs in the 50s and 60s and 70s made those programs possible. There was no government involved in everyday life before 1933. Calvin Coolidge and Warren G. Harding, the two Republican predecessors to Herbert Hoover, who was in office during the Great Crash in 1929, wanted to have so little federal government that if it closed down, nobody noticed. And that the main place most people saw the federal government was at the post office, and only there. And so, yes, it's very difficult right now. I am not denying that it's a scary time, but it is nowhere near as bad. And when people are out of work, there is unemployment compensation, which was recently increased. And there are food programs all over the place to, through the government, to help people out. So it is a collapse unlike anybody has ever seen in the 1930s. We've seen versions of this before.
Can Obama take the lessons of the New Deal and apply them to the current situation? For example, the public works program, which he has proposed to put people to work, rebuilding the nation's infrastructure, roads and bridges mm-hmm. and such. It sounds, at least in vague conceptual terms, reminiscent of FDR.
Sure. There's a couple problems with that. First of all, let's use Tennessee as an example. Tennessee was known as a drive-by state or drive-around state because the roads in this state were so terrible, no one could drive on them. And so what the New Deal did was come in and build roads. It also built other sort infrastructure mechanisms, electricity. Before the New Deal, TVA and the Rural Electrification Administration, the REA, 9 in 10 rural Southerners did not have electricity. When they got finished, 9 in 10 Tennesseans and in the South had electricity. So what the New Deal did was come in and create new infrastructure that would allow for markets to be built and to grow. And Tennessee has taken off since then, the growth of the Sun Belt. Oak Ridge came in because of the TVA project at Norris Dam. That would not have happened unless that infrastructure had been put in place. It created a potential for a new economy. And that's the lesson that we need to learn from the New Deal, is that where government can help create new economies, it can be very, very effective. Infrastructure improvement, however, when, you know, go back and fix the bridges, sure, it's a short-term fix, though. It doesn't have the long-term ramifications that the farm-to-markets road building program through the WPA, Works Progress Administration, had in Tennessee during the 1930s. There's also some problems with the economic models that they're using as well. Herbert Hoover, the president during the initial crash, worked under classical economic theory. And there were four basic precepts, but it was, in general, modeled on the idea of a rocking boat. It was a God-given calamity. Markets were not things that humans could manipulate. It's a God-given thing. And like a rocky boat, we just need to wait for the boat to settle and even out. When Roosevelt came in, he recognized that he needed a different kind of economic philosophy because he had a new kind of economics that he had to deal with. And that's the economics of the manufacturing sector that had just come into fruition into everyday life in the 1920s. And so he used a different model called John Maynard Keynes' model of the Keynesian economics. And it's based on the idea of an elevator, that when in good times, the government should have should be at the top floor. The car should go to the top floor, and the government's portion of the GDP should be very, very small. But when things are really bad, the elevator car needs to go down, and the government's in representing the government's greater share of the GDP. And then when things get good, the GDP goes back. And basically, you know, in really crass terms, it's throwing money at the problem. Well, right now, throwing lots of money at the problem, I don't think is going to work because we're working with a government where the elevator never went back up to the top. In 1932, the government had 3% of the gross domestic product in the United States. It has 20% now. And so to keep throwing money at something that the government has already been throwing money at has some real problems. And so there needs to be a new kind of economic philosophy put in place in order to meet the demands of the new economy that came online in the 80s and 90s and today. And that economy is a global one based on the information age. And it requires different kinds of banking regulations, a different way of seeing It needs a leaner, more flexible economy that can meet certain conditions.
It would also need an entirely new mindset in Washington by comparison to the last 8 years, would it not? Because we Americans, especially under the prior or the current administration, the still current administration, the lame duck administration, see ourselves as very independent, very unilateral, not exactly isolationist, but still seeing ourselves as THE superpower in the world as opposed to a country that is integrated into the entire global network. Do we Americans, can we put our egos on hold long enough to think of ourselves as citizens of the world in order to adopt this new global mindset?
I think a couple things about that. First of all, I think there are no choices right now. I think if we want to stave off the conditions of the 1930s, that we need to figure this out. The second thing is that what Obama is promising is a leaner, more flexible model of government that operates with more transparency and, in his words, a greater sense of honest, open policy. If we want to, this crash should have happened probably 5 or 6 years ago. And I don't mean to use the word crash, but the decline should have happened 5 or 6 years ago. What has kept it up has been the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, the money being spent on those, and the housing bubble between 2003 and 2007. Those two things have allowed false rises in speculation and in war profits that we should have been talking about this a long time ago. In some ways, Bill Clinton did start talking about it. With his reaching out to other global economic powers, Germany, Western Europe, trying to do stuff with the peace process in the Middle East, things like that. And the fact that his wife is now is Secretary of State elect.
Designate,
thank you. I think is a way of saying to the world, we're willing to go back to the Bill Clinton model. They've also started talking with the defense secretary, Robert Gates, about the defense money being used to shore up State Department money, in which all the money's been going to fight wars as a tool of diplomacy. Let's stop sending bombs and troops places, let's start sending diplomats. And so let's shift some of the money to the diplomatic corps, beef that up, and send Americans out, not necessarily like a Peace Corps sort of thing, but as diplomats, as people of goodwill to go to other countries and shore up our reputation that way, decenter it that way. So there's a lot of, to answer your question about how do we get people to move from the mindset of the last 8 years into a sort of new mindset, part of it's we don't have a choice. Second of all, there's leadership already in Washington wanting this. And some of them, Robert Gates being the best example, are holdovers of the last administration. And so I think it's going to be a relatively easy sell. Now, once people begin to see the economic benefits of being part of that, we can also begin to address some of the other new economy issues in the United States. There have been some discussion about new kinds of environmental programs that could be a new economy to take people from the old economy, people who've lost jobs due to overseas migration of various corporations. It's hit Tennessee very, very hard. And so one of those environmental companies can do things, infrastructure improvements, such as putting smart meters on people's homes, which tell you how much electricity you're using at a given time, and also is able to measure when you're using electricity at the highest rate portions of the day, so that you're reminded of it and you run your dishwasher at night when it's cheaper.
Right.
Go back and re-tighten up people's homes so that they're more efficient. I think the new language of this new administration is going to be efficiency. Another thing is to put in a new economic philosophy in which the behavioral economists like Christine Romer, that he has chosen to be on various advisory committees or head the budget office, what they're saying is that to learn how people spend money as a way to cut costs for doing various government programs. For example, they've discovered that when people are on Medicare and have to buy their prescriptions month by month by month, that causes people to skip months because they're not able to pay for the prescription copayments each month.
Right.
And what that happens then is that people don't take their medication, they get sicker, it's more expensive for Medicare. So they're toying with some ideas such as causing people to pay one payment for all 12 prescriptions. That's awful expensive, so they've got to think about that. But they're operating off of the idea that people behave in certain rational ways about, and people would say lazy, but certain rational ways about spending money. How do we take no about those rational ways and say use them to save money for the government?
So what we're really talking about for an Obama administration is less someone who is looking to prior models, mm-hmm. and someone who's going to have to look to the academic world, which he is doing in part, and to the business world, which he's doing in part, and to the governmental world, which he's doing in part, and really reinvent a whole new approach instead of cherry picking, if you will, from the prior administrations mm-hmm. and creating a mosaic of past remedies.
Well, if Obama, the lessons that Obama is learning from the New Deal, and maybe I'm shifting my thinking a bit here, he's not taking the economic policies, he's not remodeling the New Deal. What he is doing is learning some of the lessons that Roosevelt learned. One, who's your band of experts? Academics. Because Roosevelt knew that. He had his brain trust, and they were a lot of them were academics.
His kitchen cabinet.
Yeah, the Columbia University economists who were heading various programs, for example. But also his ability to speak direct, his communication skills, his understanding that you have to speak directly to Americans and motivate them to be a part of this as well. Those people who had given money to the Obama camp for the presidential election are part of a new database now in which people who have given money are still receiving emails from him saying, this is what you're going to do next. And so there's 3 million people on that list, including something, actually there's more than 3 million because there's 1 million or so people from the state of Tennessee gave money to Obama's cabinet, or they gave 1.8 million to the presidential election. He's got a direct voice to those people, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, all those new different kind of technologies. He's not using radio like Roosevelt did, but he understands that new technology gives him opportunities to speak to people in ways that gets him straight to the people and out of the way of mainstream media that can be very critical of a president.
Something that I heard some conservative Tennesseans saying just in water cooler conversations back during the campaign was that they would not vote for Obama because they were afraid that he was a socialist. This struck me as really Cold War ideological talk that was counterproductive and not necessarily relevant to the times that we face today. They made it sound as though the choice were let the invisible hand guide the free market on the one hand and a Soviet model on the other. And it seemed as though they were in a bit of a time warp. Talk about that in a minute about ideology versus pragmatism when a president takes the reins of power and moves into the White House.
Well, part of the issue, too, is a sort of black and white thinking. There's other ways of doing it. When Roosevelt was in office, he was called a socialist as well and a traitor to his class. Keynesian economics is a conservative response to the Great Depression. That what he was trying to do was save capitalism by making it relatively safe. At the time, he was charged with socialism. Now, that idea of socialism as being something really bad and horrible and evil was reinvented in the 1950s, certainly with the Cold War with Russia, that the Russian model of economics, which then fed into its political structure as well, was godless and evil, and they're only trying to take us over and turn the whole world into their model. And Russia was never, and I'm not a Russian historian, but Russia was never secure enough, stable enough to ever even come close to doing anything like that. Russia lost 25 million people during World War II. There were maternalist policies after the war in which they recognized that nationwide, there was one man for every three women, and in some places in the country, one man for every seven women, and they just needed people to just start having babies. There was never a realistic moment where socialism could really take over the world, and especially the United States. Moreover, socialism is the ownership of the means of production by the working class, traditionally, intellectually, and historically. And so I've had some problems with people who said, well, this is socialism, because they see socialism or communism, as it's manifested itself in governmental policy, as being the ownership of the means of production by the government in a centralized model in which the government owns everything. And they're two different things. So the language is also very difficult there as well. Obama, when he comes into, and so it's a very uninteresting way of seeing government, and it's one that I think lost McCain the election, because beyond the fact that it didn't give a clear sense of understanding what socialism was, A, B, he's reaching back to the 1950s to find solutions to the problems, and it made him look old and decrepit and out of touch. He's the 20th century, Obama's the 21st century, we live in the 21st century. That being said, Obama, I think, is going to be a lot like FDR in that he understands he's saving capitalism, that the government does not take over ownership of things. Government is a catalyst, and it incites change. It doesn't pay for it, and it doesn't buy it. And that's a very different model than a socialist model or a communist model based on either the intellectual roots of it or the actual political manifestations in places like Russia. So we have to keep in mind that Obama is a free market capitalist who believes in the free market and using government as an incentive. One of the examples that we can give is when he was a senator, he offered GM a new program called Healthcare for Hybrids. In exchange for the government taking on some of the pensioners' costs, because that's where a lot of GM's money goes toward taking care of its retired UAW workers who need health care. The government offered to incentivize that in order for GM to start building hybrids. GM said no thanks.
They could have done something at that time, and they didn't.
It's really pathetic when the history professor can run a business better or see possibilities for the future for a large Fortune 500 company better than its own leaders.
You mentioned before we went on the air about when Truman was president and World War II, the mobilization thereof, helping to the mobilization for the war, which happened under Roosevelt, helping to further lift us out of the economic doldrums, and Truman's concern when he became president about war profiteering. Only 8 years after Truman left office, Eisenhower, on his last speech out, warned America about the growing military-industrial complex. We should have taken heed, because it was coming from the mouth of a general who knew whereof he spoke. And yet today we have a humongous military-industrial complex from which some private companies are profiteering mightily. Talk about that in historical terms.
Well, keep in mind that the New Deal did not work in the short term. It worked in the long term. And there are many reasons why it didn't work, but one of them is the amount of money that was spent on it. It was considered radical and revolutionary, and yet they spent $15 billion on it. World War II proved that Keynes was right, because if you spend enough money, and in the case of World War II, it was $100 billion, you could pull an economy out of a depression. Now, Harry Truman, during World War II, was a senator from Missouri, and Truman was a remarkable person in that he was very historically minded. He was a student of the Civil War and of Abraham Lincoln in particular, and he understood that wars were places where industrialists made money through profiteering. And he knew the stories of people providing food and shoes and clothing and armaments for the Union armies, and paying millions and millions of dollars for that, and the army's getting horse meat to eat and cardboard in the shoes that were made for them to wear on the field. And so what he did is he set up a committee that has a fancy name but became known as the Truman Committee. And the Truman Committee was designed to root out war profiteering in the industries. In just the setup of training camps across the nation, Truman saved the War Department $15 million. And he made his name and became vice president because of that committee. His willingness to say, in times of war, there's a lot of patriotism going on, but not all the people running the corporations are willing to cut their profits. They see it as a time to make money. Fast forward to 2003, 2004. The war in Iraq and Afghanistan has been privatized significantly through the use of no-bid or superficial bid processes, and then no oversight on various governmental functions dealing with the war. And they didn't stop with the war. They've also been privatizing collection, for example, of the IRS in ways that are profoundly unethical and undemocratic. In the case of the IRS, for example, the phone call to the person owing money to the IRS will start something like this. The message on the machine will be, "Hi, this is Brandy. I need to talk to you about your account. Please call me at this number." And when you call Brandy back, this light, beautiful, little, sexy little woman's voice, she says, "I can't tell you what it is until you give me your Social Security number." In a democracy, open records, open knowledge is required. The IRS is required to name itself, to say, "This is what we are investigating you for." And you're, as a citizen of the United States, you have certain rights and as well as responsibilities. The IRS has also proven to be far more efficient in gathering the money that is owed to the U.S. government. And so what Obama needs to take from these lessons is Truman's emphasis on watching wartime profiteering, because a lot of that deficit in there is from that. And the Black Hawk scandal, where 17 Iraqis were killed because the Black Hawk folks said that they were being shot at, is highly problematic. In a democracy, soldiers are required to behave in a certain way, in an ethical way that makes friends as well as win wars. And private contractors are not under those same ethical, financial, moral obligations in many ways. And so Obama has to take a look at those. He also has to take a look at the fact that so much of the government has been privatized. In no way am I saying that business, by its very nature, is trying to cheat the American taxpayer. But I do know historically that profiteering is something that goes along with patriotism whenever a war is being fought.
Mm-hmm. Much is made about the first 100 days of an administration, as though that were some sort of a magic number. Does that matter? And is that whole concept overblown? Obama has said he intends to hit the ground running, and by all indications, he's already been working on it to a great degree. What is so special about the first 100 days of a presidential administration?
Well, first of all, let me say that the period between the election and the inauguration was always called the lame duck period. And until 1933, the lame duck period went from the election day to March 4th, 19-whatever. And it was done so because back in the olden days of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, it took 3 months to get through the roads to the Capitol to actually attend the inauguration. With cars and planes and things like that, inauguration day needed to be moved up. And George Norris, for whom the Norris Dam was named for, proposed an amendment in 1932 to move the lame duck period up to January 20th. And it was ratified relatively quickly in less than 10 months, or about 10 months. And it wasn't ratified in time for Franklin Roosevelt to be put into office early. And so the 100 days, when he got in, it was 5 months after, and that glorious 100 days of Roosevelt's initial year. He shut the banks down and reopened three quarters of them 4 days later after he discovered that they were actually financially solvent. He put forward the AAA, which was an agricultural set of programs. He put forward the initial beginnings of the TVA. He put forward the Civilian Conservation Corps, which was, beside the TVA, the most popular, I think, of all the New Deal programs. And so waiting 5 months and then having to get going, the 100 days meant something very, very significant, because the worst part of the Great Depression was that winter of 32 and 33. It mattered. The thing is, though, is that economies these days are run based on perception as much by actual behavior. And so a couple weeks ago, Obama received some criticism that he was trying to be very diplomatic to George Bush. And I think both of them have been so courteous to the other. It's been lovely to see a democracy, a shift like this, be done so courteously and so morally and ethically.
Because the whole world is watching and they are looking. The impression both men want to give is, this is how you do it in a democracy,
exactly,
folks.
Exactly. But Obama was staying off stage. Obama shows up and they said, you know what, you need to share your face. Let us know that you're thinking about this. And he said, okay. He shows up three times in 1 week. Stock market lifted. Because the perception was, as he showed up and was making this announcement and that announcement and this appointment, the markets calmed and started to go up. And that was that week or so before Thanksgiving. And we had a couple days there where, because perception these days runs economies as well as. So it's that the 100 days matter, but they don't matter as the first 100 days in office. It's that politics of perception that begins on November 5th, 2008, and moves forward. He will have actual voting power and legal power as of January 20th, but that politics of perception is already being done.
We just might have you back after the first 100 days to do a retrospective and look forward a little bit. But we're out of time right now. Thank you. Chris McCusker, who is a professor of history at MTSU. This is MTSU on the Record. I'm Jenna Logue. Join us again at the same time next Sunday. Don't forget, we're available at mtsunews.com. You can listen to the podcast at your leisure there, and we're also on iTunes.